This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can listen to us on Pacifica radio stations and watch our show on Free Speech TV. I have to confess that I've never known much about Donald Trump before he emerged on the political scene. When he won the Republican nomination for president, I forced myself to learn more about him, assuming that after November 8th, I would never have to waste my attention on a person who seemed more of a joke than a serious politician. And now we have 4 long years of trying to make sense of what a presidency under the unlikeliest of presidents is going to be like. To understand where Donald Trump came from, I read the Washington Post's book about the New York businessman. It's called Trump Revealed: An American Journey of Ambition, Ego, Money, and Power. Written by Michael Cranish and Mark Fisher, Trump Revealed is a detailed story of Trump's early business dealings, his relationships and influences, his frailties, and desire for recognition and power. Joining me now to discuss the book is Mark Fisher. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and senior editor at The Washington Post. His earlier books include Something in the Air and After the Wall. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's begin this story of Donald Trump and who he is. And I should really confess, I sort of actively avoided having to learn about him because I imagined, like many others, after November 8th, I wouldn't have to think about him. Let's talk about his father, Fred Trump, and the business that Donald began working on with his father that sort of launched his own business and helped him differentiate from his father the kind of businessman he wanted to be. What sort of housing was Fred Trump involved in New York, and what was Donald Trump's role in that?
Well, Fred Trump was one of the largest builders of middle-class housing in New York City, not in Manhattan, but rather in Brooklyn and Queens, in the outer boroughs, in neighborhoods that were really expanding enormously in the mid-century. And he was building these apartments primarily for immigrant families, many of them Jewish, who were either first or second generation immigrants, and who were moving up from perhaps tenements or housing projects into this middle class housing that was rental housing. It was decent quality. Many people lived in those apartments for decades. And Fred Trump was a very savvy marketer of his apartments. He would hire airplanes to fly messages over the beach at Coney Island to reach mass crowds with the brand of Trump housing. And he was someone who was very hands-on. He went around collecting rent with his son, Donald. And Fred Trump was a kind of cold, distant German immigrant who, actually his father was the immigrant, but came from an immigrant family himself. And he was not only hands-on, but he was very kind of sort of jealously guarded the business. And it was a very sort of close-knit, small business that he ran. And he was distant from his son, Donald, for many years. And then when Donald reached his teens and was old enough to hang out at the office, that's when the real bond between Fred and Donald came about. And it came about through learning the trade, going out to construction sites, getting to know the construction workers. And it was this very hands-on family business. Donald absorbed all of that, but wanted something more, wanted something different. He looked across the bridge to Manhattan, to the glamour of the core of New York City, and said, why don't we build there? And his father's view was, it's too risky. You don't want to have to borrow all that money. He always warned his son Donald against borrowing money and told him to avoid that at all costs. Donald had a completely different attitude. He became very proudly called himself the king of debt. And he wanted, above all, the glamour and the attention that he would get by taking a chance at the Manhattan market, which was a very tough market in right. the 1970s when Donald crossed the bridge.
So let's talk about the controversy and the legal trouble that Fred Trump and Donald Trump, because he was working with his father, got into just at the time when Donald wanted to set his sights on Manhattan. And that was that the U.S. government basically realized that there was some very serious serious housing discrimination happening, particularly against African Americans. To this day, Donald Trump sort of tries to finesse and spin what happened. But essentially, as you tell in your book, the people, his managers, were told to either turn away African American tenants or to push them to one particular part of the housing development. What does that represent, particularly today, when we have President-elect Trump? What do we know about that early part of his career where it didn't seem to rile him very much that racial discrimination was something he built his business on?
Well, Fred Trump's business was built on attracting middle-class white families, mostly ethnic minorities in New York City, ethnic immigrants, whether they were from Eastern Europe or other parts of the world. Now, there was a very strong policy that the Trump organization had against renting to black families, and so at least renting in their premier properties. So when black families would come to try to rent from Fred Trump, they would fill out an application, and then their application would be scored by the employees of Trump's management, and we would either get a number 9 put at the top or capital letter C for colored. And those applications were then either just put aside, or those applicants were sometimes told, I'm sorry, we don't have anything for you. Other times they were told, yes, we do have something, but not in the place where you're looking, rather in one of our other developments in a less desirable place. And so the government came in, federal government came in and tested this by having couples, interracial couples, a black and a white, go in and successively make exactly the same request. And the white person would be told, yes, come on in, we welcome you, and here are your options. And the black person would be told, no, you know, we have nothing left, or we only have this one particular place. And the government was able to prove this by sending in these testers. So there was a federal lawsuit in which both Donald and his father and their company were sued. And at that time, this is the early 1970s, Donald happened to be at a nightclub in Manhattan where he met his future mentor, Roy Cohn, the infamous lawyer who represented, worked with Senator Joseph McCarthy in the red baiting days of the 1950s against purported communists in government. And Cohn, who's an extremely aggressive lawyer, took Trump under his wing, and the first problem that they tackled together was this discrimination lawsuit. And Donald Trump said, what do I do? The government wants me to settle. And Roy Cohn said, never settle. You need to be extremely aggressive about fighting back. In fact, you need to sue them for a lot more than they're suing you. And so there ensued a countersuit against the federal government, a personal attack on the young prosecutor, a woman who had gone to great lengths to investigate this, this pattern of discrimination. Now, that's the story that Donald Trump tells. What actually happened is that Trump did indeed settle after 2 years of avoiding it. And this became a real pattern in Donald Trump's life, where he takes great pride in telling people that he never settles lawsuits, when in fact he settles 98% of them.
Right, and in fact,
in this case,
I understand that he basically ended up settling for basically what he would have if he had just acquiesced the very first time around. But let's stay on Roy Cohn for a minute, because it seems as that was a very momentous point in his life. You say in your book, from the moment he met Roy Cohn, he adopted the Cohn playbook. When attacked, counterattack with overwhelming force. Has that been a sort of theme in Trump's career, that even at moments when it seems as though he is, you know, going bankrupt or losing at something, that his attitude is to just fight back as hard as possible?
Well, as we've all seen in the last year, he makes a big public show of saying that he never settles, of saying that he's pushing back and of calling names and in every possible way attacking those who attack him, whether it's Rosie O'Donnell or Megyn Kelly or the Republican presidential candidate. So we've all seen how that works in Donald Trump's life. But what's important to know is that this stretches way back before the campaign. This goes throughout his entire career. But it's also important to draw a distinction between what he does publicly, where the counterattack is part of his overall strategy of winning public opinion. And then privately, it's a very different story. We talked to quite a number of people for Trump Revealed who had worked with Donald Trump through the decades, who had faced off against him in business deals that went bad and so on. And what they said over and over again, whether they liked him or disliked him, was that once the cameras are off and once he's in private in a negotiation, he's kind of a pushover. And that tough talk and that kind of posing that he does for the cameras is really quite contrary to the kind of soft-spoken and very easily manipulated character who they find in a negotiation.
Wow.
And that's why, in many cases, the ultimate settlements of lawsuits are really very much in the favor of whoever it is that is going up against Donald Trump.
And now, of course, he is going to be occupying the White House. Let's take a look at his business dealings and how he managed to get his start. I mean, first of all, it was remarkable to me that very much parallel to the development of his own brand, his own company, was this push to manipulate the media, something he has continued to do all through today. One of the earliest assertions he made about himself was his worth, his financial worth. And you point out in your book that he said very early on that he was worth $200 million. This was at a time when his worth was nowhere even close to that, right?
Yes. In fact, this is a pattern that we see throughout Donald Trump's life. And it's probably the single thing about himself that he's most sensitive about. In fact, when Comedy Central, the cable channel, did a roast of Donald Trump some years ago, the way those things normally work, the comedians get a sheet of paper that says, here are the topics that you really should steer clear of. You can make fun of a lot of things, but steer clear of this. And usually it's about family relationships or the person's children that you shouldn't make fun of. In Donald Trump's case, what the comedians were told was, go ahead and make fun of the children, go ahead and make fun of the ex-wives, but the one thing you cannot make fun of is whether he's really as rich as he says he is. And so if you go back and look at that roast on YouTube, you'll find that no one makes fun of how rich Donald Trump really is. It's a point on which he's extremely sensitive. And as you say, it's something that he has been sort of ballooning way beyond the facts going all through his life. Hmm. And so we document in Trump Revealed how at the very beginning of his career, he positioned himself as someone who was worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and this at a time when he had mere tens of thousands of dollars in his bank accounts. And this pattern continued for many years. We can't say for sure exactly how much he's worth today because he hasn't released his tax returns as every presidential candidate and president has in modern history. But what we can say is that he's worth nowhere near what he says he's worth. And this came out, ironically, in a case where Donald Trump sued a previous biographer for $5 billion in a libel case, which Trump made a big deal of saying he would never settle. And then, of course, he settled. And in that case, Trump was deposed and he was asked by the lawyers, where did you come up with this notion that you're worth whatever he was saying back then, $8 billion, $10 billion, $12 billion? And his answer was, it depends on how I feel on a given day.
Wow.
And now that sounds like an utterly ridiculous statement. He sounds like he says, oh, I'm lying. Yes, to some extent, but there's also some validity there because obviously when you are your brand as he is and you're trying to get people to come to your golf courses, hotels, and restaurants and so on, people are coming because of your name. And so your name has a particular value and you can assign a number to that. Now, he happens to assign a number that's way beyond what anyone else would assign. But that's where he gets to those sky-high numbers that he's always talking about.
So, Mark, tell us about Trump the hustler, because very early on in his career, one of the most important things that he sort of decides to demarcate himself with is the Trump Tower, this shining ode to himself with his name on it in Manhattan at a time when people weren't really optimistic about the city's development and real estate future. And you point out that he had just no money to start this venture. And what he did was very effectively play one sort of person or one institution against the other to force this deal to happen. Tell us a little bit about that story and whether it is an indication of how he does business.
Yeah, it's very much an indication of how he does business and of how he will govern as president. He is a master of making things look like they're farther along than they really are, or that he's thought things through when he really hasn't. This was true from his very first project in New York City, where he converted the old Commodore Hotel into a Grand Hyatt. He'd never done a major project before. He'd certainly never done anything in Manhattan. But he was able, through working the politicians, working the banks, and the other corporations involved with the project, and making each think that he had money already guaranteed from the other. So he would go to the banks and say, oh, don't worry, I've got a deal with Hyatt. It's already set. They'll be funding some portion of this project. And then he'd go to Hyatt and say, even though he had no deal with them yet, he'd say, well, the banks are on board. We're going to have the money. So you want to come on board and be the franchisee at this hotel. And then he'd go to the government and say, hey, look, I have all this support from the banks and from Hyatt. And so you should give me the tax incentives I'm seeking. And they all came aboard. They all said yes. And sometimes they were skeptical. He would stage events when people were skeptical. So there was one time when in Atlantic City, he had a project that really hadn't started yet at all, but he had construction workers pretend to be moving pieces of plywood and doing clearance of a site in order to persuade bankers that this project was already up and running. And so we see story after story like this in Atlantic City, in Manhattan, where he stages theatrical events in order to persuade lenders or other investors to come along with him. Similarly, when he was going bankrupt, he had six corporate bankruptcies in his Atlantic City period, and the banks were coming after him, and they had every right to take every property from him. He had to persuade them that they needed him more alive than dead, and he did. And there was a middle-of-the-night meeting with all the bankers where he basically laid it out to them and said, you can take these properties, but you're going to lose everything. You leave me and my name on it, you're going to get some business, you're going to get some of your money back. And he was able to persuade them. So whether you call that hustling or savvy business or great theatrics, that has been a pattern throughout his career.
Right, which might be okay to do if you're a businessman, but when you are president, of course, that's the big question. And we want to continue on that in a moment. But I want to stop and focus a little bit on the issue of women and Donald Trump. Your outlet broke the story of the Hollywood Access tapes that really made it a huge, important headline around what Donald Trump really thinks about women. And in your book, you go back and a little bit go through some of the relationships he's had. It doesn't seem as though it's very easy to pin him down one way or another necessarily. It's not that he's been completely misogynist and anti-woman. He even has hired women and put them in positions of power. And his first wife, Ivana, was someone that he actually ended up deputizing to be part of his business, right?
Yes, Ivana Trump was not only part of his business, but she was given sole management control over one of his casinos in Atlantic City and then over the Plaza Hotel in New York City. And that did not work out well. Donald Trump felt threatened by that. He felt that he did not want to have pleasure and business mixed in that way. And he resolved never again to be involved romantically with someone who was also going to be part of his business. And as we've seen, his second and third wives have not been part of the business. And in fact, even today, we see it's his adult children who play the role of working with him in the Trump Organization, not his wife. But Donald Trump's relationship with women is, as you say, rather puzzling in some ways. But there are consistent threads and themes. And one of them is that much of what he does with women and the role that women play in his life is very much for show. It's very much a another of these theatrical performances. And what I mean by that is we went back and talked to quite a number of the women who Donald Trump had made himself publicly linked with romantically back in the 1970s and 80s. Trump, either as himself or using a fake name, would call the various gossip columnists and TV reporters and say, you know, if you go out to Studio 54 tonight, you're going to see Donald Trump with Madonna or with another celebrity or with the hottest models of the day. And so we contacted quite a number of the women who had been linked in those gossip columns to Donald Trump and said, what happened after the cameras went off? And every last one of them said the same thing. They said, you know, as soon as the cameras were off and the reporters were gone, he had no further interest. Huh. And he wanted to go home by himself, watch TV, and eat a bag of candy.
So it's all part of his public persona?
Yes. So he wanted to build this public persona as a playboy, as a rich guy who people would feel they wanted to be like. So, and it was part of building this whole brand image of aspiration, of here is a guy who lives the lifestyle that people might aspire to and builds the products that they might want to live in or play at or visit. And so that that image of himself as the gallivanting playboy on the New York nightlife scene was very much part of selling, of marketing the Trump brand. Now, how does that comport with all the allegations that we saw not only in the Access Hollywood situation, but all the two dozen women who came forward after that? Quite a number of women who we document in the book had really difficult and unfortunate dealings with him personally. Almost all of those cases are, again, incidents that took place in public or semi-public places, at a banquet, in a dining hall, on an airplane. And so when he's doing these kind of groping episodes that later got him in trouble, he's doing it in this weirdly semi-public way, almost as if to say to other guys, hey, look at me, I'm achieving whatever I'm achieving with these women, if you want to use that word. And so it's interesting, there are no allegations of things happening in private or of rape,
except for his own wife, right, Ivana?
Well, yes, that is true. His wife Ivana did accuse him in a book she wrote of raping her. By the time the book was actually published, she had backed off that at his insistence. And in fact, when the book was published, the flyleaf to the book includes something of a disclaimer in which Ivana Trump says that she didn't mean rape in the criminal sense. So you can see her sort of backing off, in part perhaps because she is to this day financially tied in with Donald Trump. So yes, there are a lot of allegations, and they have certain similarities that make them quite credible. But it's also interesting to hear a great many accounts of Donald Trump as a very solitary figure, a real loner who tends to live in Trump Tower and stay there really before the campaign. He didn't leave Trump Tower that much. He was someone who was really quite a recluse of sorts.
Let's talk about his move to reality television. I don't follow reality TV, and so I'd only ever really heard the connection of Trump with The Apprentice. But what did that represent for the Trump brand? We know that he's never shied away from glitz and glamour, and even, sort of overly done glitz and glamour. For him, was it a natural step to be part of The Apprentice? And if so, what did that represent for his career?
Yes, absolutely. Doing The Apprentice really had two main purposes for Donald Trump. Number one, he needed the money. His building empire was not doing well. He had a series of setbacks, including a long series of bankruptcies in Atlantic City. The casino business had not worked out for him in the end. And he was in the process of switching to a new business model in which he was essentially renting out his name to all sorts of products that he didn't even make himself. And as part of that sort of rebranding, he felt that the reputation that he had earned through the 1980s and 90s, this kind of tabloid reputation of the soap opera divorces and kind of a cartoon character, he felt that he wanted to change that if he ever had a chance to go ahead and go into politics and perhaps run for president. And so he saw The Apprentice as his chance to reach middle America with kind of a retooled version of who Donald Trump is, presenting himself as a decisive chief executive, as someone who would speak truth to power, as someone who would not be deterred from saying what was really going on and didn't traffic in niceties and euphemisms. And so he thought that this show would get him this enormous national audience, and he would be able to build this new image of himself. And in fact, it was an instant hit, and that success did exactly what he was hoping for. And a lot of the NBC executives who approved airing the show didn't see this coming. And it's only in retrospect that they were able to say, oh my goodness, he was planning this shift into politics from the start, and this show was the vehicle for doing that.
And interestingly enough, he's not a diehard Republican. Initially, he joined the Democratic Party, right? He hobnobbed with the Clintons.
Well, absolutely. He, in fact, has had seven changes of party registration: Democratic, Republican, Reform Party, Independent, back to the Democrats, back to the Republicans. And this is a very good indicator of just how allergic to ideology Donald Trump is. He takes great pride in being what he would call a situationist, a pragmatist, someone who really is opposed to people who have strong ideologies of any stripe. He's as derisive of conservative Republicans as he is of liberal Democrats. Now, through his years, he hasn't shown much consistency in his positions, except on a few social issues. And in fact, he told us in interviews back during the spring and early summer that he was going to outflank Hillary Clinton on her left on social issues. And if you recall, he did, in fact, come up with this child care plan that was well to the left of anything Hillary Clinton had proposed. He has been a very vocal supporter of gay rights going back to the 1970s, while Hillary Clinton had struggled with the issue and really wasn't willing to take a stand until just the last couple of years. So he did do that, and he does have those views, and he sees his daughter Ivanka as the his ally in maybe taking a bit of a left turn on some social issues. And yet, as we've seen through the campaign and now the transition, he's equally likely or willing or even eager to ally himself with right-wing causes when that proves to be popular. So he's not someone who has thought much about or really cares much about ideology. He thinks of himself as the consummate deal maker who will make whatever deal is going to make him more popular.
Right. And then the question becomes, who's he going to sell out in the process of making that deal? I mean, on social issues where reproductive rights for women are concerned, he seems to have gone way, way, way to the right of Hillary Clinton, even though historically he had a different position, right?
Yes, he's been all over the board on abortion, and there's no reason to believe that he's found a position that he's going to stick with. So during the campaign, we did indeed see him take very strong positions against abortion rights. And then suddenly after he was elected, he went on 60 Minutes and basically said that Roe versus Wade is perhaps settled law. So we've seen him in recent weeks backing away from any number of the promises he made during the campaign. Donald Trump's great belief, if he has a core principle at all, is that he wants to remain always unpredictable. And so I think we can say that he's fairly achieved that on some of these key issues.
And let's finally talk about the process of writing the book. You mentioned that you interviewed him and he gave some interviews in spring. On the back cover of your book, you've got some amusing quotes by Trump, the first of which is him dismissing your book to the New York Post, saying it's ridiculous, they know nothing about me, I won't be reading it. And then the next three quotes are from interviews that he gave you and your co-author. So how did that process come about? You contacted him and he agreed because he thought maybe it would be better to actually talk to you?
Yeah, so we decided in late March to go ahead and do, as we do every 4 years, a major biographical study of the nominees. And we put out the word in publishing circles that we would like to do this both in the Washington Post and as a book. And there wasn't much interest from publishers about a book on Hillary Clinton because her own books and books about her had not done well on the market. So we went ahead and did our biographical work for the Washington Post about her. But in Trump's case, we decided to go ahead with this book, and Scribner decided to publish it. And so the first thing I did after we made that deal was call Donald Trump's press secretary, Hope Hicks, and say, we're planning to do this book, and we'd love to sit down with Trump for a series of interviews about his life and career. And she interrupted me before I'd even finished explaining what we were doing, and she said, you are profiteering off Mr. Trump, and we will not be cooperating. And beyond the irony of someone like Trump accusing us of profiteering, I thought, well, you know, we thought that might well be the case, and we had a plan to go ahead and report the book around him without him. Well, that was on a Friday. Well, lo and behold, the following Monday, the press secretary calls me back, and she said, her voice was completely different. She was all peaches and cream. And she said, I told Mr. Trump about your fabulous idea for a book, and he loved it. And he'd love for you to come up to Trump Tower as often as you'd like. And what she hadn't foreseen was that her boss, first of all, could not turn down the opportunity to talk about himself, but also that Trump very much enjoys the banter with the media. And although he loves bashing the media and threatening the media, he also has built his career on working with and toying with and manipulating and bashing news organizations and reporters. And so he invited us in, and he was extremely gracious. He gave us more than 25 hours of interviews for the book. And, you know, he took all questions. He was quite gracious. He doesn't answer all of them in full. And it's very hard to have a linear conversation with him. He's kind of all over the place. But on certain things, particularly his business, he was quite forthcoming and quite knowledgeable. On other things, anything beyond his business, he really had a very thin knowledge base and was unable to answer many questions.
So, Mark, it seems as though, just from reading your book and hearing you describe him, we have a person in office. I mean, in living memory, we haven't had such a person in, you know, who's going to be occupying the White House. But it seems as though he's somebody who has really, he's insecure, has a big ego, is full of braggadocio, you know, puts forward an appearance of what he would like to be rather than what he really is. And at the heart of it all, at the end of the day, he's a businessman and not necessarily a great one at that. What does this mean as someone who is now dug deep into his past? What is your assessment of the kind of president he's going to be? So many of us seem to be in a sort of collective mourning over his election because we just can't believe it's happening.
Well, you know, Donald Trump is certainly unlike any president we've ever had before. He's unlike any politician, really. He's not a politician, and he's someone who was never accepted in the worlds that he was successful in. If you go around and talk, as we did, to the other major builders in New York City, they are utterly derisive of him. They resent the fact that he is even in their same industry. And Donald Trump has worn this cloak of resentments all of his life, and he believes that he's never been accepted in any field that he's in. So there is a certain insecurity there, as you say. There's also a deep streak of narcissism that he's actually written about in one of his books, where he sees narcissism as essential to success as a chief executive. And this is an area that we tried to probe with him. He's not very good at talking about his own emotional life. But to the extent that he would, we presented to him, I said, you know, you've worked all of your life to build your own wealth and build your own reputation. And there's a long trail of people who are destroyed in the process. And whether they're your competitors or people who worked for you or people in government, many of them have been destroyed. People whose bills you wouldn't pay, people whose reputations you attacked. And he said, yes, that's true. I said, well, then why would anyone believe that you would be able or willing to work for the 300 million people you now represent as president? And he said, All those years, I was working just for Donald Trump. And so I didn't care what happened to anyone else. He said, now I'm going to be working for the American people, so I'll be working for them. And I said, well, how do you make that pivot when you've never done anything like that in your life? There's nothing in your history that shows that you are able to have that empathy, that ability to listen, that ability to compromise. And he said, it's not a problem, I'll just do it. And he has this belief that he can simply change, that he can simply pivot. In that way, it is a supreme act of confidence, but it is an act, and we don't know whether he really will be able to do it. One thing we do know for sure is that he will continue operating the way he always has, and that is as a front man, as someone who's all about the image. We are seeing that now with the carrier decision in Indiana. We're seeing it with the way he's trying to spin the telephone call with the premier of Taiwan. He is all about putting the image out there and seeing if people will believe it and then adjusting if they don't. But he does not do the behind-the-scenes work. He does not do the day-to-day, hour-to-hour work. And so the question about his presidency will be, who will do that work and who will be directing what work that is? Is it something that Trump will simply pass on and allow, or is it something that he will want to direct? There's no history of directing in that fashion, but that's what we're going to have to find out.
Do you think that we could get him to do the right thing by playing on his ego? I mean, Trump seems more upset about the press using unflattering images of him and Alec Baldwin's caricature of him on Saturday Night Live. And some people have suggested, well, let's cause him to completely implode by simply making fun of him.
Well, as Hillary Clinton successfully showed in the first debate, he's someone who is easily goaded. And so she set out to throw him off course, and she did. And so it's not difficult to do that. And his competitors and his opponents realize that. And certainly other nations will realize that. And so there will be a temptation among the leaders of our rivals and around the world to use that in whatever dealings they have with a President Trump. It should also be noted, however, that he is not someone who gets terribly involved in these things, and he likes to kind of skate along the surface. It's hard to say what will really happen. What we can say is that he is easily frustrated about these kinds of things, and that the people who are closest to him know that whoever is last in the room with him often gets their way. And so there will be a tremendous competition that we'll see among the people that he's now appointing to be that last person in the room, to be the one who makes the final point. And because he's relatively easy to sway, his executives through the years would compete to see who could stay in the office the longest to make sure that they were there at the decision moment so that they would get their way. Wow. That's the kind of competition that we're likely to see in a Trump White House.
Wow. Mark Fisher, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and for the work you've done on putting this book together. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Mark Fisher. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and senior editor at The Washington Post, author of Something in the Air and After the Wall. We've been discussing the book he's co-authored with Michael Cranish. It's called Trump Revealed, An American Journey of Ambition, Ego, Money, and Power. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.